is Clark Howard on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM News Talk WSB.
This Tuesday afternoon, I'm Elise Glenk, sitting in for Clark today. Thanks for joining us here on the Clark Howard Show. Our phone number, 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK, online all the time, thinkglink.com, thinkglink.com. And don't forget to check out the new site at thinklink.com. Easier search, more articles, helpful information, everything that you need to make smarter decisions with your money. So we have a lot to talk about today. Have you ever wanted to foreclose on your bank? Are you so mad that you can't wait to just basically put a lock on the door and say, you know, that's for you? Well, there's one couple that actually got a chance to do that, and we'll tell you about that a little bit later on the show. So cool, and a judge agreed, and guess what? They had a very positive outcome, so we'll talk about that coming up. I wanted to start today with First American CoreLogic's new report out this morning. They found that nearly 40% of homeowners who borrowed against their homes are underwater with their mortgages. Their house is worth less than the total cost, total amount that they owe on their first and second loans. There are so many calls that we've had to this show and to my show on Sunday from people who borrowed second mortgage money and now find they're way far underwater. Well, you are not alone. 38% of borrowers who took cash out of their residences using home equity loans or lines of credit are underwater and owe more than the home is worth. By contrast, CoreLogic's study found that only 18% of borrowers who don't have a home equity loan are underwater. That's really huge. Now, it's not clear how much cash that was withdrawn was used to acquire automobiles, boats, planes, trains, you know, whatever, or renovations that were actually intended to raise the home's value. Unclear on that. But according to the Federal Reserve Board, homeowners took out, get this, $2.69 trillion. Now, we often talk about millions and billions on this show. Trillions is usually left for the deficit, but homeowners took out almost $3 trillion at the height of the housing boom just between 2004 and 2006, and that includes cash-out refinances. Okay, that's a huge amount of money. A huge amount of money that is never coming back because 40% of those homeowners who have those loans are now underwater. That equity has completely disappeared. It's absolutely astonishing. So for home prices that have already fallen back to where they were in 2002, and yesterday we talked about how home prices fell back in Atlanta all the way to 1998, 1999, or perhaps even further. We had a call yesterday from somebody who said that the price of their home, they're really sure, is back to where it was in like 1989. So you have that. What you're showing is a direct correlation between people who were told their homes were worth more, went in with easy lending standards. Remember, it was only a few years ago that if you had a pulse, a bank would be happy to hand you a check for $50,000 or $35,000 without even pulling anything on the house or your credit. I guess it was credit, but that was it. And so you have really deep levels of negative equity on these people who have second mortgages, an average of $83,000 per homeowner compared with $52,000. This isn't the amount that's borrowed, folks. This is the amount that they're underwater. This is the amount that they're underwater, an average of $83,000 compared to $52,000 for borrowers without second mortgages. All this easy access hasn't done anyone any good. And if you want an even bigger number, not quite as big as that trillion-dollar number, but approximately three-quarters of almost $1 trillion in home equity loans outstanding were held by commercial banks at the end of last year. 40%, so we're looking at about $300 billion is held on the banks of books of the four biggest banks: Wells Fargo, Bank of America, JP Morgan Chase, and Citi. Now, If you do, that, this is where it gets interesting. If you follow along with the whole mark-to-market idea, and banks are supposed to say that where their loans are actually valued, those $300 billion of loans are mostly gone. That value is mostly gone. And so it's likely that number is never coming back. So what would happen if the bank suddenly said, we have $300 billion less than we thought on our books? Well, it could throw their whole capital ratios out of line. And so the federal government's been kind of nice about it and said, no, you don't really have to do mark-to-market on that. It's a big shell game. Big shell game. This is, it's the kind of report that sort of says, well, at least we understand that there are bodies buried somewhere along the way. Just not sure how many trillions of dollars of them there are. Makes me absolutely crazy. 404-872-0750. Do you have a second mortgage on your house? And if you do, are you underwater? How far underwater are you? Are you breaking even? Do you still have equity in the house? 404-872-0750. Or you can tweet me. I'm at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. All right, let's go to the phones. It's 13 minutes past the hour on the Clark Howard Show. Terry joins us on the line. Hi, Terry.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm good. What's going on today?
My wife and I'm in the military, and I recently had my home appraised. We bought it for $220,000, and it was appraised at $180,000. I'm trying to lower my interest rate, which I qualify for. However, you know, I had to come up with the, you know, take money out of savings or do something else to come up with the other money.
Right. That's a lot of money. So you're underwater $40,000.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Do you have just one loan or you also have a home equity loan?
Just one.
Okay.
My current interest rate is at 6.2%.
When did you buy the house?
2007.
Okay, right at the height of the market.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, and did you use a VA loan or did you use an FHA loan?
I did use a VA loan, yes.
Okay, and did you call the VA and or your lender and try to get just a streamlined VA refinance?
No, I didn't.
So
I went through USAA.
So here's the thing that you might be able to do, and this is available to FHA and VA loans. There's something called a VA Streamline Refinance where you call up your existing lender and they don't actually do an appraisal of the property.
Okay.
They simply lower your interest rate. They'll probably look at your credit, but it's about $200 or $300 that you pay. It's not another refinance. And they just simply lower the amount of your interest. So if you would qualify, go from 6.2%, maybe go to 5.5%. You won't get the super lowest interest rate, but it should be lower than where you are now, and it should only cost you a few $100.
That's great.
All right, and see if that works. And if it doesn't, call the VA, because you have a VA loan, and talk to their housing group. There's a local, I'm sure you know where your local VA office is, but there's a VA housing office that you can call as well.
Okay, ma'am.
And ask them to help you out if your lender will not help you.
Okay.
All right?
I appreciate it.
And thank you for your service to this country.
Thank you, ma'am.
All right. Bye. 15 minutes past the hour on the Clark Howard Show, 404-872-0750. Michael joins us on the line from Lilburn. Hi, Michael.
Hey, Elise. How are you doing today?
You know, hot but loving it. It's finally summer.
It's very hot out there. Elise, I got a question for you. I'm getting these emails that are wanting me to give out my personal information. They want me to click this link in the email. But here's the deal. The bank that I'm getting these from, I'm not even with this bank. I've never been with this bank.
Mm-hmm.
I'm with a branch here in Atlanta, been with them for 15 years. This other bank is sending me emails, and they're a pretty big bank, you know, nationwide. And they're the ones that's sending me these emails. First email I got, they're asking me to click on the link and then provide with my personal information, Social Security number, account number, and everything. Then about a month later, I'm getting these emails, and this one came to my spam filter from the same bank, and it says, Dear Michael, we wanted to let you know that your information has been updated. Please click on this link to verify that we have all of your correct information.
So, Michael, you're not actually clicking on these, are you?
No, I'm not clicking on the link because I was afraid it might have been a virus. So
it is. I'm sure it's. If it's not a virus, it's vishing or phishing. You know, it's the spam stuff that we've warned about for years on the show. You should never click through and give personal information on an email because a legitimate company that's really reaching out to you won't do that. It's very likely that some scam operation somewhere overseas has basically stolen the logos of these big banks, and they're the ones trying to approach you. I get emails all the time to update my Chase account and update my U.S. bank account. I don't have relationships with any of those banks. There's no reason for them to be sending it. It's all completely spam. I even get emails, because I still maintain an AOL address, I get emails there all the time that my AOL information is out of date. But that AOL tells you they're not going to do that.
Yeah. I was going to ask you, though, I mean, if you would like me to, I'm really new at this. I just know it's criminal information. Would you like for me to forward you these emails, and that way you can take a look at it, and then maybe you can know the person who to forward this on to, because I don't want to get these emails anymore.
Well, what you want to do is every time you get one of those, you just hit spam. You have a spam option on your email address. Don't send them to me. When you click on spam, what that does is it marks that email as spam. If they're using a direct marketing program, that direct marketing program will get a black mark. And most servers keep track of how many black mark spam you get. And if you get too many, they just shut you down. So the most effective thing you can do is mark that as spam and then immediately delete it.
Okay, will do.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks for sharing, Michael. We really appreciate it. 18 minutes past the hour, 404-872-0750. Brant joins us on the line from Grayson. Hey, Brant.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. What can I do for you today?
Well, I have a question. It's kind of a complicated story, but anyways, I have two mortgages on my house that originated when I bought it, a first and a second. I did an 80-20 split.
Yep.
And
are you underwater now with your loan?
I'm underwater, but I think I'm like everybody else. I'm definitely upside down. It's not some mega amount. The problem I have is I got out of work for about 10 months and got behind on my mortgage 60 days.
Mm-hmm.
They processed it into foreclosure. At that point, I only found out about that because I called to try and make a payment on it, and they told me I could not. At that point, I entered into a repayment agreement with them, gave them quite a sufficient amount of money for the deposit on the repayment agreement. It's twice what they were asking for, and then had kept making regular payments on the repayment agreement. Well, my second mortgager, I called to make a payment with them. I mostly did it online. It's a very small amount, but it didn't take online, so I called, picked up the phone to make the payment, and they told me that they had processed my home into foreclosure because my original lien holder, or the first mortgage, had put it into foreclosure, even though I told them that the original or first mortgage had rescinded the sale of the property and they had made a mistake and everything. That's going on 6 months ago, and I still cannot get anybody at my first mortgage company, after every other day of talking to them for an hour, to send something to my second mortgage company saying that it was a mistake on their part.
Okay. So the second mortgage company, is it a big, huge company like Bank of America, or is it a smaller company?
They're both big, evil, huge companies.
Okay. So you want to go to helpwithmybank.gov.
Okay.
Helpwithmybank.gov. This is the site that is on behalf of the regulator that regulates the big banks.
Okay.
Right, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency they're the administrator of national banks under the Treasury Department.
All right.
And you want to file a big fat complaint about the first and the second lender, but primarily the second lender. First lender's not helping you out at all.
Oh, no. It's ridiculous how much they're not helping.
I know. So you're going to file a complaint. You're going to tell your story in a very organized, date-driven way with you know, help the people and whatever the paper trail is. You're going to file your complaint, and hopefully that's going to spur on your both of your lender to talk to each other. It sounds like it's the same lender. Talk to the different departments and make a move on your behalf. If that doesn't happen, you can file another complaint with the OCC through helpwithmybank.gov. And it hopefully at some point in time will get the ball rolling for you. 21 minutes past the hour on the Clark Howard Show. I'm Elise Kling. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with more on News Talk WSB.
This is Clark. I'm not here today, but you're still getting money-saving info from money expert and author Elise Kling on News Talk WSB.
27 minutes past the hour. Groupon is going into groceries. We're going to have that story coming up 36 minutes past the hour. Stay tuned for that. In the meantime, Sherwood joins us on the line from Decatur. Hey, Sherwood.
Hey, Elise, you do a great job filling in for Clark. I hope nothing ever happens to him, but if it should, you've got the job.
Oh, blush, blush, blush. Thank you.
Listen, my dear, here's my deal. I've got a CD coming due in a next few days, $50,000 CD. I'm very old. As a matter of fact, I'm almost 90 years old, but you wouldn't think so.
I don't think so.
But anyway, I just need to know what your suggestion is that I should do for that. I don't anticipate needing the money, but I don't want to lock it up forever. So, you know, what do you say?
I'd say do a 6 months, take half of it and put it into a 6 month CD and half of it into a 1 year CD.
Okay.
And then you can redo in 6 months the other part. You'll get a little bit more interest in the 1 year and then figure
right,
it out from there.
Well, see, I got a bank that'll give me 2% for 5 years, but I don't know.
And no, it's not worth the that's not worth the risk, Sherwood.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Too long a period of time.
Right, yeah. Elise, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thanks for calling the show. 20 minutes past the hour. It is good to know my own employment is secure. I wish Sherwood were writing the checks. 404-872-0750. If you are a fan of Groupon, you're going to really like this deal that Groupon's got coming up next. We're going to talk about it after news, weather, and traffic. And then we're going to do the economy. There's some more news to talk about, of course. Seems like all kinds of things are heating up, and it's not just the weather. 28 minutes past the hour on the Clark Howard Show. I'm Elise Kling. Stay tuned. We'll be back with more on News Talk WSB.
Clark Howard on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM News Talk WSB.
Welcome back to the Clark Howard Show. I'm Elise Flink. It is 36 minutes past the hour. Hot, sunny day here in Atlanta. 404-872-0750 is our number here at the station. Don't forget to go online. Check out my website, thinklink.com, thinklink.com. All kinds of great information to help you make smarter decisions with your money. So I'm sure you know about Groupon or Living Social, all the same kind of community. But Groupon's the one that started it. They are an organization where they basically sell you a discount to a particular product or service at a specific company. And right now they're mostly known for things like restaurants or massages or manicures or pedicures or sometimes clothing. They really kicked it off with a big sale for Gap. Remember that? It was like 2 years ago. And you could buy a pair of Gap jeans for $20. And the way Groupon works sort of behind the scenes is they ask the retailer to give them some sort of amazing discount, price it where at a place that's cheaper than anything else, and then they take half or sometimes a third of what the amount is. So, for example, with Gap jeans, if it was $20, Groupon would get $10 for every pair of jeans that are purchased, and Gap would get the rest. So now Groupon has just announced today that they are making a move up the retail food chain, and they're aiming a new pilot program at supermarket Shoppers. So they've joined up with a Springfield, Mass-based grocer called Big Y Foods, and they're going to offer Groupons for groceries. But the way that Groupon works today is you do it online, and then you have to print the coupon, and you bring it in. But they want to figure out a way to avoid having to do the print part so that you actually seamlessly get your Groupon discount. So you'd have to register online somehow, and then when you go shopping, the grocery Groupon would just be discounted off the final bill. And so what they've done is they're tapping into the loyalty cards that you get at this particular grocery store, the loyalty cards, they're tapping into those. And so if you, or let's say I sign up for it, and I have a loyalty card from Big Y Foods, my Groupon would actually be discounted off my checkout. You know, I'd get the receipt, it would be there, subtracted at the bottom. And so it's really a test to see if Chicago-based Groupon can adapt daily deals to retailers sort of beyond the small merchants that are the core business, right? And this is one way to test it out. And so they are looking at large retailers with multi-stores, multi-store environments, as they like to call it, and multiple checkout lanes. So think grocery stores or think Home Depot or Lowe's, right? And they're trying to figure out a way to make it work. And so they're going to launch the product this coming week. I think maybe it was yesterday, maybe today. Oh, I think it's today. They're launching it today in Springfield, Mass. And if it's successful, Groupon says they already have all kinds of grocery stores that are lined up. Really interesting. So right now you can only do it at the Big Y in Springfield, Mass. Kind of a long trip, a lot of gas that you'd have to spend to get a Groupon if you live in Atlanta, but coming soon, probably, hopefully, to a grocery store near you. 404-872-0750. Let's go back to the phones. Mark joins us on the line. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the Clark Howard Show.
Well, how are you doing today?
Great. What about you?
Doing well. I've calmed my nerves a little bit from this little issue I have with my credit card company. Yes.
Uh-oh. So. You're having a credit freak out. What's happening?
Well, what happened was I had a high balance on one of my credit cards, and I was actually able to go ahead and pay it off in April. And before paying it off, I called them up and said what my balance was, and they told me an amount of like $2,800, and that'll take care of my balance and everything like that. They said yes, it would. I went ahead, went online and did my banking and issued them a check online, and that was it. Well, I knew I was a zero balance, and so I got a statement from them, and via email I get the statements, and I didn't even open it up. And then yesterday in the mail I got a letter from them saying that I owe $47.84. And I went to my credit card account and looked it up, and I had a balance of like $16, and then there was a $30 late charge because I missed a payment on it. And so I called them up and I said, what was the deal? Because I thought it was a zero balance payment. And they said, no, it's, you have a revolving credit, so the balance was not paid off, and it was on and on. I think it was just a total load of malarkey.
Well, if you had actually, when you went online to pay them, did you have a check issued, or did you do an automatic withdrawal for the same day?
I had a check issued.
So the problem, I think, is that you issued the check, and about 4 or 5 days later, the check turned up.
Exactly, yeah.
So you weren't really, what you were being given, which probably wasn't clear to you, but they thought they were being clear. This is like communication issue 101. You thought that the $2,800 would be good up until probably the next time your closing date was.
Exactly, yeah.
And they were telling you, no, the interest accrues kind of daily and not once a month, and so every day that you don't pay that balance, more money accrues. So they were giving you, if you pay this today, this is what it is.
Exactly. And
so I don't think you're being given a load. I think what you're being given is, I don't even know if it's miscommunication, it's just bad communication.
Well, no, and that's fine. I understand that, and that's understandable. But to hit me with a $25 or $30 late fee for not paying when I've been a customer for so long and never been late with a payment and stuff, that's what got my goat going.
But how come you didn't look to see?
Because I just assumed I got a statement from them, it was just a zero balance. I've gotten statements from other credit card companies that have zero balances, and I never opened them up.
Because you thought it was a zero balance, but you always, it's a great lesson. You really have to always check.
Exactly.
Really have to always check. Well, so how high was your blood pressure? Did they agree to remove the late payment?
No, that's the part that I really got me upset. The late payment was more than the actual amount that was due. And,
yeah.
You know, like I said, I've been a customer of theirs for such a long time. When I lived in New York, I banked with them. I still had a credit. And I said all that, and it's like, no, nothing I can do about it. Sorry.
Did you go to the retention department?
I did. And I just said, well, I'll never use you again. I'll use up all my points for some mileage, for some trips, and then never use your credit card again. I'm going to trash it. And she said, well, that's your privilege to do. Thank you very much.
Okay, well, at least they were polite, but really irritating. I wouldn't necessarily, if you've had that card for years, you're not, of course, going to cancel it because it doesn't do you any good.
No,
it's like cutting off your nose to spite your face. So
exactly.
You're going to just pay it, and lesson learned, always open up your accounts. And you know what? You should open up your account every month anyway, all the zero balances, because if somebody has stolen your card, You need to know about that.
That's true.
And if you don't open it up, you're never going to know. Somebody's charging $10,000 worth of electronics equipment from Zambia.
And then I wouldn't even know about it.
Then you'd be really unhappy.
Oh, I was going to go to the local branch and pay it in pennies, but my wife got the better of me, so I didn't do that. So. Thank you, Elise. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mark. Thanks for sharing your story. It's a great teaching lesson for everybody. 43 minutes past the hour, 404-872-0750. Shayla joins us on the line from Jonesboro. Did I pronounce your name correctly?
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What's on your mind?
Yes, I have a question. I have a $20,000 save. Should I pay off the balance I owe on my car, which is $19,000, because I want to get out of debt? Or should I sell my car for what it is worth, $13,000, and pay the remaining balance out of the $20,000 and get another car?
Okay.
What do you suggest?
Well, let's talk about that. If you pay off the balance of the car, how old is the car?
It is a 2008, but I got it in January of 2009.
Okay, so you got it in 2009, so it's just 2 years old.
Right.
Why would you get rid of a two-year-old car?
Well,
you've already taken the hit. You've already taken the hit on it with depreciation.
That's true.
So here's what I'm thinking. If you get, let's talk about, you know, you pay it off today, whatever your interest rate is. How much is your interest rate?
It's 9%. And
you are earning 9% on your money. You can't get that anywhere.
Okay.
It's a guaranteed fix. And then what I would like to have you do is, how much is your payment each month?
$477.
Okay, you're still used to making that $477 payment. I want you to make that $477 payment to yourself, preferably into a Roth IRA if you're not already doing that.
And I'm not.
Okay, so I want you to open up a Roth IRA, and every month I want you to put $477 in until you hit $5,000.
Okay.
Because $5,000 is the place that, you know, is the amount that you're allowed to put in for somebody who's under the age of 50, and you sound to me like you're under the age of 50.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, if you went the other direction, here's the problem with it. Your car's worth $13,000, so you have to take the $20,000, and now you're going to spend $6,000 to pay off the debt on the car, and now you have to go buy another car. So
right.
The same. Now you only have $14,000 left to buy a car, and I guarantee you're not going to get a car that you know that's as good as your two-year-old one for $14,000.
Right.
So you'll spend more than $14,000.
Mm-hmm.
So this, and you're going to pay to sell it, you're going to pay to buy it. I think that's not a good plan. But paying off your car, so you're out of debt, and now you're packing away, $477 a month, I'm all in favor of that. And plus, I want you to keep this car until it is at least 10 years old.
Okay.
So that's my plan for you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Elise.
You are very welcome, Shayla. Thank you for calling the show. You stay cool today. 45 minutes past the hour, 404-872-0750 here on News Talk WSB. Michael joins us on the line from Stockbridge. Hi, Michael.
Hi, how are you, Lisa?
I'm good. So what's going on in your world today?
Well, I guess I could say I'm in a predicament, and I'm trying to kind of figure out what my best options are in terms of, you know, moving forward and getting out of it, I guess. Unfortunately, went through a divorce and was left with the house, or as part of the decree, the house is, I'm living in it, and then I am actually supposed to get rid of that house, sell the house, put it on the market. But unfortunately, the market, as you know, is not very good, and
no. The
area that I'm in is a declining area, so I don't see any light ahead as far as, you know, it that changing. And I've talked to some realtors and, you know, around that area that, you know, do business around that area, and they've given me some, you know, prices that they thought that, you know, I may be able to get for it, which was, you know, under what I owe. And they also gave me some, you know, some of the recent sales around the area, I guess, the comp. And
so it's looking like a short sale. It's like a short sale, right? I mean, it's just a question of how far below is it going to be. Is your ex-spouse going to help you make up the difference?
That I don't know. I mean, I would hope, being that we're both, you know, both of our names are on the mortgage, but I'm not sure that's, you know, I'm currently making the payments. I mean, I'm current on all my payments, so that's really not an issue at this point in terms of it's just sunk cost. I mean, I'm trying to just get out of it and say, what do I do? You know, but I'd love to be able to just wipe the slate clean and move forward, but I'm not sure how you do that in the situation that I'm in. And,
well, you know,
the thing is, we don't have the capital or the, you know, the liquid, I guess, in cash to bring to the table to make up that difference. You know, if let's say.
Well, give me some numbers so I understand. What's that? What did you pay? What do you have on the balance of the mortgage?
The balance is a little over, I think it's about $93,000.
Okay, and how much do you think you can get for the house?
Well, based on just the other sales around the area, I'm thinking if I'm lucky, you know, maybe in the 80s, if I'm lucky.
Okay, so
even
you have two...
The house appraised for more than, you know, more than even what I owe on it, there's just no way that based on what's going on around there.
Okay, so Michael, listen, this is where you're kind of sitting, right? So after expenses, because if you sell the house for $80,000, you're still going to have to pay broker's commission. So you're really looking at netting out around $73,000. I'm guessing there's going to be a missing balance of about $20,000.
Right.
If you can come up with $10,000 and your spouse, ex-spouse, can come up with
$10,000,
you guys are going to walk away clean. Do you have, other than in qualified retirement accounts, do you have any other assets? Because if they think that you do, they're going to come after you.
Yeah, no. We don't have any other assets other than, like you just mentioned, any...
qualified retirement accounts.
Right.
Okay. So what you ought to do is you need to call the bank or you need to hire an agent who actually has ties, knows how to do short sales and has ties to your lender. And then you're going to contact the lender and you're going to say, I need to get out of the house. We think we can only get probably about $80,000 for it. The balance is $93,000. And after the expenses, it's probably going to be more like we're netting out at $73,000. Will you accept that? And then the lender will go get a broker price opinion, a BPO, and they're going to figure out exactly how much they're willing to take, and then you're going to price this house and try to sell it. The other option that you have is to rent out the house for the next few years and hope that prices start to increase a little bit, and you can go live elsewhere for less money if you can get enough rent to cover your expenses. Those are going to be your two ways to kind of move on. And if you choose selling the house, I really encourage you to use somebody who really understands short sales so that you can work with somebody who's the process is long and arduous, and I want to make sure that you're actually finding somebody who understands that and works with it as opposed to against it. And that's really going to be the best way to get out and move on. 50 minutes past the hour on the Clark Howard Show. I'm Elise Klink sitting in for Clark. We'll be right back with more on News Talk WSB.
This is Clark. I'm not here today, but you're still getting money-saving info from money expert and author Elise Klink on News Talk WSB.
56 minutes past the hour, News Talk WSB. Coming up at about 7 minutes past the hour, we're going to talk a little bit about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and a new proposal to replace them. Is it a good deal for the American taxpayer? I am not so sure, but we're going to walk it through just after news, weather, and traffic at the top of the hour. Let's go to the phones and see if we can help some more people. Stephanie joins us on the line from Athens. Hi, Stephanie.
Good afternoon. How are you doing today?
I'm good. What's on your mind?
I was calling because our mortgage company sent us a packet of information about a government program called Making Home Affordable.
Oh, yes.
And it's talking about lowering your interest rate, and we aren't having trouble paying our mortgage payment, but I thought, well, if we can get this program and get a lower interest rate, because I've tried to refinance, and based on the way that our loan was done initially, we would actually be paying more if we refinance, even though we have a 7% interest rate. And I've talked to so many people, and people hear me say that, and they think, you have a 7% interest rate? How could you possibly be paying more to refinance? But we don't pay PMI.
Mm-hmm. So, because you did the 80-20?
No, ma'am. We financed 30 years just a straight normal loan. And everybody says that if we refinance, even on a lower interest rate, we would be paying more in the long run because we're not paying PMI. And so I just didn't know with this program, because it's talking about getting a 4-something percent interest rate, is it something that you have to be honestly having trouble paying your payment, or is it just for anybody, or I don't know anything about it.
There were a couple of things. First of all, let me give you the website where you can go and find out more information about the government's program. This is not a loan modification program. It's the Making Home Affordable Refinance Program. Some people qualify this for this and some people don't. And it's not about whether or not you can pay your mortgage. I think it's just about making it, as they say, a little bit more affordable. Very few people have qualified for this. So I'll start right out there. But you can go to makinghomeaffordable.gov. Makinghomeaffordable.gov. If you qualify, basically they're going to refinance you and lower the interest rate. I would also call the company that sent it to you, but don't apply yet. Really try and understand. I don't really understand enough about your mortgage to understand why you don't pay PMI. I think what happened is you are paying it, but they factored it into the interest rate, and that's why your interest rate is so high. So it's possible that that's really what happened to you. But you have a complicated situation, and I think you should do a little bit more investigating before you figure out what the best road is going to be. But makinghomeaffordable.gov is a good place to start. 59 minutes past the hour. I'm Elise Glink. We'll talk about Fannie and Freddie next on News Talk WSB.
This is Clark Howard on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM News Talk WSB.
Welcome back to the Clark Howard Show. I'm Elise Glink, sitting in for Clark today. He'll be back tomorrow. Glad you could join us on this very hot day here in Atlanta. 404-872-0750 is our number, my website where we are online all the time, thinkglink.com, thinkglink.com. You can follow me on Twitter. You can join the fan page. You can even listen on Sunday mornings at 11 to the Elise Glink Show if you just want a little more Glink. No problem there. Back when I was first covering real estate in the late 80s, early 90s, I learned about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And in Chicago, Fannie Mae is a candy company, so it took a while to figure out how to spell it so it would be different. But because we're F-A-N-N-Y for yummy chocolates. But Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are the lending behemoths of the secondary mortgage market. The primary mortgage market, or where the retail mortgage market, as we call it, is when you want to go get a loan, you go to a lender, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, SunTrust, whoever it is. Those organizations, those companies, then turn around and they resell the loans to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac primarily, although now FHA is playing a huge part of that, and then they get their money back and they can make another loan. And so that's how we get what we call liquidity in the mortgage market. You go to a lender, lender goes to Fannie, Freddie. There's something called automated underwriting where everybody gets an automatic yes. That's pretty much how they set it up. The money comes back to the retail lenders and then goes back to the next buyer. Pretty interesting system. Worked really well until securitization went completely out of whack and everybody stopped caring about whether anybody had any better credit rating than basically a pulse. And that was back in, like, I don't know, 2000, 2001. It started to go really bananas. So Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac announced, I think it was yesterday or maybe it was this morning, that they're going to need another $42 billion with a B, billion dollars to, you know, pay off all these bad loans. And I think the total price amount for how much we're going to pay to support Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac is somewhere north of $600 or $700 billion. I mean, we're talking about some serious cash. And this is not cash like at Chrysler that's just going to come back to us. This isn't like that at all. So the problem with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac is that there was this implicit agreement that Fannie and Freddie, no matter what, had the support of the U.S. government, that everything they were doing was backed by the full faith and credit of the U.S. government. And so they were able to get better rates, and they were able to make buckets and buckets and buckets of money. Okay. And now it's become clear that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were a disaster, and the American taxpayer is the one that's basically heave-hoing the $700 billion or $800 billion or whatever the number comes out to be that we are paying for all of these failed business decisions. So it's okay to say, right now, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are basically in corporate bankruptcy. They're in a conservatorship where the U.S. government is basically taking them over as little wings. And now there's talk about eliminating them because we want to get rid of them, right? They're bad. They've cost us a lot of money. The problem is you can't go back to the way banks used to lend back in, like, say, the 1930s and 40s, which was an individual bank would make a loan for $5,000 to buy a house to somebody. That's just not how banks work anymore, and they're not set up to use their deposits that way. Maybe they should be, but they're not. And so the idea is to replace Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac with something else, something better, something that's not going to cost the American taxpayer $700 billion. Preferably something that would bring down the deficit, right, and not add to it. And preferably something that would not cause the federal government to grow further, right, because we all want to shrink the federal government and not grow it. So it was very surprising to see that House Bill 1859, H.R. 1859, was introduced by Representative John Campbell of California, a conservative Republican. And he basically is introducing a bill that would set up a government-based housing finance program that some people think is even worse, even more destructive, and even more dangerous to the American taxpayer than Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Hard to believe. Hard to believe. And yet, here's how the whole idea of it would work, right? Basically, you eliminate the GSEs, which is what Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are, but you replace them, right? You replace them with something very similar, housing finance guarantee associations that have the power to guarantee mortgage-backed securities. And these would be fully backed by the faith and full faith and credit of the United States, whereas Freddie and Fannie were implicitly backed, and look how much that cost us. Now, these would be fully backed by the U.S. government. How do you have a private organization that's 100% fully backed by the federal government? I don't understand. I really just don't understand. So this is just going to make have more to worry about. And I think you should be outraged. I'm kind of outraged by this because what's really going on behind the scenes, folks, what's going on behind the scenes is that those four big banks and a few others, you know, the ones that have, $400 billion in home equity gone bad, maybe $700 million in home equity loans gone bad, the big banks all want the right to securitize mortgages. They've seen how much money you can print with this. This is like a money printing machine. At least it was until it all went bad. But now they're betting it won't go bad again for another 30, 40 years. So, hey, there's lots of money to be made. And they want to do it without any real oversight. They want the Federal Housing Finance Agency to have the authority to impose a fee for the government's guarantee. So this would be like, let's see ones that really work well. Oh, the National Flood Insurance Program, not quite sound, but they want to model it on that. Or let me think of another one. Oh, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. We know that that thing's just basically underwater. So the idea that people are going to pay a fee for the insurance is ludicrous. Not for the full faith and credit of the United States. It's really unclear to me why Mr. Campbell, Representative Campbell, thinks this is a good idea. It's not going to fix anything. All you're doing is you're giving a big plum to the big banks. They don't even want the SEC involved. Nothing. In fact, the Housing Finance Guarantee Associations would be exempt from SEC registration. So it requires them to pay close details to the quality of the mortgages they're underwriting, but are they really going to do that when the whole thing is backed by the full faith and credit of the United States government? I don't think so. So I think it's kind of surprising, shocking even, that this is being touted as the next big wave. And let me tell you something. I've been in press conferences where this has been discussed for the last 4 or 5 years. And, you know, Fannie and Freddie were watched for a long, long time, and everybody thought Fannie and Freddie were trying to get into the retail business, and the banks were squabbling amongst themselves, and they're still squabbling amongst themselves. But I really, this is just not in our best interest. You are far better off letting Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, if you're going to do the full faith and credit, why invent a new system? Just have the government take over Fannie and Freddie and just keep running it, because we do need liquidity in the mortgage market, or you won't be able to get a loan the next time you go there. This idea where you're going to give private companies that are probably that trade on the stock exchange the right to have the full faith and credit of the U.S. government, maybe I'm missing something, but it just doesn't seem like the right move for the American taxpayer. And I don't know about you, my taxes are high enough. 404-872-0750, 15 minutes past the hour. Let's go back to the phones. Melanie joins us on the line. Hi, Melanie.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm good. How about you?
I can't complain.
What's on your mind?
I have a question. My credit is not the best.
but I work an hour away from home. I tried the buy here, pay here places, but the cars they give you seem to break down. There's someone who knows a place, and I know several people that have gotten cars from here, and that you can get a brand new car, but the interest rate is very high. I was wondering, would it make sense to get a car, because I have to be able to get to work, from the new car and just pay on it until my credit rises and then go somewhere and refinance it?
I would rather see you not buy a new car, but I'd rather see you go to a place like CarMax, where at least you're buying a used car, but it's guaranteed and they do all sorts of inspections to it. And I would rather see you buy an inexpensive car, even if you have a high interest rate, but an inexpensive car that you can actually go back to a big company in case something happens.
CarMax declined it.
CarMax declined you?
Yes.
Oh, it's my favorite place to go. What are you using now to get to the office, to get to your work?
I've been getting a ride, but that's going to stop here pretty soon.
Because they don't want to, you can't contribute to the gas, or because they're going to lose their job?
No, they just can't continue to make sure I get back and forth to work. They work as well.
Okay. So is there somebody, what is the least expensive option? Does somebody have a car you can borrow and help pay for that car? Can you share a car?
No, I know no one I can share a car with, and there's no transportation, public transportation where I live.
You're in a really tough spot. Then I think what you're going to have to do is get a new car, but the interest rate is going to be super high.
Correct. But would it make sense to refinance it after maybe a year or two?
I don't know that you'll be able to. What's your credit score at right now?
518.
It's really low.
Yes.
Why is it so low?
Because I've had a lot of problems with different moves and things from different boyfriends. And so I've just had a lot of problems, and I never really paid attention to my credit. I'm trying to learn how to reestablish credit now.
Okay. Well, okay. So what I guess I would say is you probably are going to have to bite the bullet. If you absolutely have to have a car, you can only get a new car. What's the interest rate they want to charge you? I'm so afraid to even ask that question.
Probably around 20%.
Ooh. Buy the cheapest new car that you can. So if you can get into a teeny tiny year old but never sold by the company Subaru,
mm-hmm.
Or some other, you know, kind of a car that's like maybe $15,000,
right,
or less, that would be the way to go. Get the cheapest new car that you can get that will work, that has a warranty, but nothing fancy, stripped down. Maybe it has air conditioning, but maybe not power or anything else, right?
Okay.
So I get that, and then if you're paying the extra high interest rate, at least it's not in an expensive car.
Right.
And hopefully it's affordable. My big concern is you do this and it's not affordable, and then it just kills your credit even further.
Well, my payment would be probably around $500 a month, and I think that I could afford that. I do have a pretty good job, and I've been on my job for about 4 years now.
Okay. Well, as long as it's affordable for you and you've really thought about it, I think that works for me. I just want to make sure that you don't get yourself into a jam where suddenly the car's not affordable and it, you know, you have to give it back and all the rest.
Right. Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Good luck, and let me know how it goes, all right?
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye. 19 minutes past the hour on the Clark Howard Show. You know, folks, it's really Melanie's point that she's sort of rebuilding her credit right now. It is really hard to do that, and you have to go slowly over a number of years, and you have to, bit by bit, get everything in order. You have to get a piece of credit, a line of credit, like this car she's getting. You're going to have to pay on time and in full. If you have a credit card, you want to pay down the lines of credit if you have a balance, or just pay in full every single month. Really take your time to build up that credit, because it could be a year or two before you start to see real results if you're as low as Melanie is. It's 19 past the hour. I'm Elise Glink. Our number 404-872-0750, or tweet me at Glink, at GLINK. You're listening to AM 750 and now 95.5 FM, News Talk WSB.
This is Clark. I'm not here today, but you're still getting money-saving info from money expert and author Elise Glink on News Talk WSB.
25 minutes past the hour, News Talk WSB. I'm Elise Glink, sitting in for Clark today. Glad you could join us. We'll have some show notes up at thinklink.com on the blog a little bit after the show today. 25 minutes past the hour, let's go to Earl. He joins us on the line from Marietta. Hey, Earl.
Hi, Elise. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What's on your mind?
I would like to freeze my credit for the bureaus. I listened to Clark, and he said the access, I could access his website and get the information. But I haven't been able to pull up the information I need to put a freeze on my credit.
All right. Well, let me tell you a little bit about it. The state of Georgia passed a security freeze law, and it went into effect on August 1st of 2008. And it is only $3 to freeze your credit. You must contact each of the three credit reporting bureaus. You pay each of them $3 to freeze it and then to unfreeze it. Now, if you're a victim of identity theft, are you a victim of identity theft?
Well, my wife had her purse stolen, and...
Okay, so
she
would not have to pay, but if you wanted to do it for you, you would have to pay.
Yeah.
All right, so you can contact the three credit reporting bureaus and let them know there's... let me ask you a question. Are you trying to do a security freeze or are you trying to put a fraud alert on the file?
Both.
Okay, so if you want to put a fraud alert... All you have to do is just pick one of the three credit reporting bureaus, and then you'll be able, they will tell the other ones that there's a fraud alert, and that'll last for 90 days. At the end of 90 days, you can extend it up to 2 years. Okay?
Okay.
To freeze, which means that your file will not be shared with creditors, you would pay the $3 for each placing or temporary lifting of the freeze. And you have to keep your PIN number that you're given, because otherwise you'll be charged $5 for the replacement. So you can do that online. Now, I actually have, I'll put the addresses and everything up on my blog this afternoon at thinklink.com, because there's three different addresses that you have to address it to for the Equifax, Security Freeze, Experian, and TransUnion. And you have to send a letter by regular or certified mail. If it's if she's a victim of identity theft, you have to include a copy of the police report, investigative report, or complaint to law enforcement agency, and you have to have all these details. Okay?
Okay. That sounds fine.
All right. So that's how you do it. And I will put up all of the addresses on thinklink.com in a little bit. Maybe I'll try to get that up during the break, and that way you'll be able to get it right away. But you definitely want to make sure that you keep your PIN. They're going to give you a PIN number, because if you don't, you're going to have to pay an extra fee to get that. But right now, you can go to the websites, let's say Equifax.com, and you can put on a fraud alert because your wife had her purse stolen. That you can do right now. 28 minutes past the hour. I'm Elise Klink. We have zombie consumer behavior to talk about. Feeling like spending money? Maybe not so much. You're not alone. We'll talk about that coming up after news, weather, and traffic on News Talk WSB.
Clark Howard on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM News Talk WSB.
Minutes past the hour on the Clark Howard Show. I'm Elise Klink. Thanks for joining us on News Talk WSB. Clark will be back tomorrow. In the meantime, I am working on that post on my website, thinklink.com, thinklink.com. I will be putting up some show notes on the blog. I've already started it. I want to make sure you get the information that you need to make very smart financial decisions. So it's sort of interesting. If you look at the amount of household debt outstanding, so how much debt we have as a percentage of disposable personal income, back somewhere around 2006-2007, the household debt outstanding as a percentage of our disposable income was somewhere around 127%, right? 127%. So if you earned $100,000, you had debt of about 127% of that, or $127,000. Pretty expensive. And a lot higher than it has been historically. And you can see the bubble where people kind of went in and tapped into things like home equity, and they borrowed all that money. Well, all that borrowing of money that we had on paper fueled a huge rise in consumer spending. And believe it or not, 70% of our economy relies on the consumer for growth. And guess who's not spending money these days? Well, none of us are spending money. I mean, we are, as the Wall Street Journal put it today, Kelly Evans, we're the zombie consumers. In the same way, he writes that corporations were walking economic debt in Japan after the stock and real estate collapse in the late 1980s, zombie U.S. consumers today could be similarly destined for years of retrenchment. And that does not bode well for growth. Now, President Obama said today he doesn't see us falling into a double-dip recession, but it's certainly easy to see that we're not spending the way that we were spending. I know that I don't spend. I never really spent that much. Clark's the same way. I mean, that's why I keep filling in for him, I suppose, because we really think about what it is we want. We've made it kind of a way of life to only buy what we absolutely need and to conserve our resources. Just in case that rainy day appears, you know, Clark and I want a really big umbrella. But a lot of other people just went out and they spent. And they've had a real reversal of fortune, and it's really difficult. And so, you know, economists are trying to decide what effect the zombie consumer is going to have. And is it going to be like the Great Depression, right, back in the 1920s, where for generations since, you hear about depression mentality. How people think about spending money was so profoundly altered during those 10 or 15 years of the Great Depression, and then the years after. You had 33, then you had 37, and what happened after that, leading up to World War II. Those people never spent the way that their children and grandchildren spend. And one wonders, I wonder, economists are wondering, are we going to ever go back to the way that we spent back in 2000 to 2005, where we felt free and money was easy? Are we going to go back there? There are signs that consumers are borrowing again, right? The Federal Reserve was supposed to report today, I didn't actually follow up on this, but they were supposed to report today that consumer credit outstanding did rise by $5.5 billion in April after a $6 billion increase in March. So it's good, but it's good that it's positive and not negative, but it's not a huge amount. What about the affordability factor? You know, the housing prices have gone down, interest rates are lower. Is that going to fuel a buying rush? Well, it doesn't seem to be doing it right now. So kind of interesting. Wonder if there's a zombie consumer index we could start quoting. Have you changed your buying habits? Are you ever going to go back to the way you were? Or is there something deep down inside of you that's changed forever? I'd love to hear what you think. 404-872-0750. And we'll ask those of you who are holding online as well, because it really speaks to the idea of whether we're going to be able to pull ourselves up out of this on the backs of people, the consumer, or is it going to have to be something else? And if it is something else, what is it going to be? Because I'm not sure anybody knows at this moment. 41 minutes past the hour, News Talk WSB. Let's go back to the phone lines. John joins us on the line. Hi, John. John, you with us?
Yeah, Lisa.
Oh, hang on. You there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, good. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. And to answer your last question, yes, my buying habits have changed forever.
How have they changed?
Well, I've paid down a lot of debt that I accrued up until about 2006. And, I'll never see myself getting in that predicament again. I mean, a big ticket item, house or car, maybe I'll finance, but other items I'm looking to save up and then buy.
You know, paying cash, it's always a great way to go. It's the safe way to go. It also gives you time to really think about whether you need that thing.
Definitely.
Well, good to hear that. What can I answer for you today?
Well, I bought my home in 2006, and almost the height of the housing thing. And right now, I did 100% financing when I purchased, and right now the home is worth about $30,000 less than what I owe on it. I did a 10-year ARM, and I'm about 4 years away from that maturing. And for about the past year, I've been trying to refi. I've been trying to do whatever I could to get a hold of this, because I know it's coming. Plus, I have some things with my job where I could move, but I can't. So I'm wondering if I have a nice 401k that I've been, you know, putting away for 7 or 8 years now, and I'm wondering if I take out a loan against the 401k and then pay myself back, is that a smart idea to pay off the second mortgage and then make the home I'll owe about what it's worth or what I could sell it for? Is that smart?
You know, I would normally say no. I'm not a huge fan of borrowing from a 401k. But in this case, if, you know, you can pay it back quickly, that's good. But if you've got some job, if you're thinking about leaving your job, you're going to have to pay everything back to the 401k in 60 days.
Well, no, I wouldn't leave my job. I would stay with the company I'm with now. I just have opportunities that might lead me to
other places.
Other parts.
Got it. Okay, so you'd be able to pay back that loan. How quickly could you pay it back, do you think?
Well, if I had to take out $30,000, it would probably take me, I would estimate, between 8 and 10 years.
That is a really long time to lose growth in your 401k.
Okay. That amount would only be about, it would be less, I mean, only about 20% of what my 401k is now.
Okay, so you have some significant amount. How old are you?
31.
You know what? I think that if you can get, if it allows you to take a bigger, better job that's going to pay you more money, and you can get out from under this house without destroying your credit, you can pay back. I'm hoping if you make more money and you are really, really careful, I'm pretty sure you can pay this loan back, $30,000, in a lot less than, 8 to 10 years. You just have to prepay it. So if you really make a commitment to pay it off in 5 years, and you just do what you have to do, keep your nose to the grindstone and get rid of it, then I would say go ahead. But just be aware that if you do decide to leave your company, you're going to have to figure out a way to pay all that money back. And getting a home equity loan to do it won't be an option.
Got it. Okay, well, that definitely answers the question.
You got tough choices ahead of you, John. It's not easy, but I admire you for wanting to be creative and borrowing from a 401k if you don't have any other cash anywhere else. I would do that, but I want to just tell you a little story. I've traveled the country over the last 2 months giving a speech called Everyday Money. The company hired me to do it and talk to their employees, and we called it Everyday Money because I think it's the choices you make every day that are going to tell whether you have resources at the end of your life. A woman came up to me and said 18 months ago her husband, who was an architect, got laid off, and at the time she had $3,000 in the bank. 18 months later, he's on unemployment, that's it. And she has her same job. She has $30,000 in the bank in 18 months. I said, how did you do that? And she said, I have to tell you, I'm ashamed at the hundreds of thousands of dollars I must have just wasted over the year with nothing to show for it. I have done nothing but pay my mortgage, my gas for my car. I've charged nothing. I've eaten out. I haven't eaten out. I haven't done anything. And in a year and a half, you know, with half the income, I've accumulated $30,000. That's the kind of commitment, John, that you need to make if you're going to take this on.
That definitely sounds kind of like me over the past 2 years. You'd be amazed at how much debt I've actually paid down. I went from 3 credit cards to 1. Minimal balance left on that. I'll probably have it paid off within 10 months or a year. And my wife the same. She had 2 or 3 credit cards, and we have her down to 1. And so we've really made some headway and have said to each other, you know, once we get those credit cards paid off, we'll be able to save a lot more, and that's definitely true and our goal. I just think that if I'm able to get out from under this house, and I could probably buy the same size house for a lot less and still save money. So, I agree that, we could do it on a lot less, that's for sure.
Well, then go ahead and do it. It sounds like you have a plan, and it sounds like the plan is already paying off dividends, and that works for me.
Okay.
So you sound like you're making the right choices and the right commitment, and you're doing it by paying all this stuff down. You're going to be able to pay down that $30,000 loan in a lot less time, because it's not just what you're paying on the second right now. Now you're going to have all of the credit card money to throw at it as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you're going to, if you do the numbers, my sense is you're really going to be able to make a stand, and it's going to work out exactly the way you want. So, John, be sure to let me know in about a year how things have worked out. 404-872-0750. Let's go back to the phone lines. Neil joins us on the line right now from Alpharetta. Hi, Neil.
Hi. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Clark Howard Show. What's on your mind?
Yes. I just had a quick question for you. In terms of my student loan, my deferment terms in February of next year, and I'm conflicted on whether or not I should do a 30-year repayment plan or if I should do the 25-year, where at the end of 25 years, the unpaid balance would be given as a tax write-off. So I'm a little conflicted on which route I should take.
I would really like to see you pay off these student loans in a lot less than 25 or 30 years.
Wow.
Any chance you can pay these off in 10 or 15 years? I mean, you're talking, how old are you now?
I'll be 38 next month.
You're talking about paying them off when you're 60? So what happens when you want to have, like, a house and a car and a vacation and a wife and kids and grandkids?
Well,
you're still going to be paying your student loans?
Well, I have that now, and that's the concern, because I don't want to be 68 just completing off my student loans.
Yeah, I don't think so. So what's the plan?
Well, the plan is that I just recently accepted a new job that has offered more money, but that hasn't taken effect yet. But so that's like 2 weeks out, and probably another 30 days out before I will receive the first paycheck from that. But within that, I mean, I'm talking about $100,000 worth of student loan debt.
Okay, and, you know, all right, so one of my producers in my office came to work for me 2.5 years ago with $80,000-something of student loans, and 2 years later, she's already paid off $35,000 of it.
Oh, wow.
Okay? It requires what I told John. Everything has to come off the table except this debt. Like, I don't think you can say to yourself 25 or 30 years. I think you have to say to yourself, what do I have to do to get this paid off in 10 to 15 years? And how am I going to make that happen? Now, my web producer, she tells me in 5 years, it's all going to be gone. The remaining money that she has left on the table is absolutely going to be paid off in another 2.5 to 3 years.
Okay, well, the problem with me is that my income had dropped because of some...
Whatever the reason is, you now have new income.
Yes.
So now you have to make new calculations. And what I want you to do, if you're, you know, you seem to say you're already married, you and your wife have to sit and think about how everything can come off the table except basically anything that will, you know, keep you from being homeless, you know? So you got to get to your job. You're going to have to buy a car. You know, you have a car. You got to keep that car for 12 years. Got to keep it running for 12 to 13 years. And your wife's got to keep her car running for 12 to 13 years. And you guys have to, you know, maybe you postpone having kids for a few years and you just spend all that money and you throw it at these loans. Because I'd really like to see that loan at half of that in about 5 years from now, because then it's going to be really easy to get it paid off. But it requires a tremendous amount of sacrifice, and you really have to watch what you're doing. But I just think, you know, if you're asking me, you know, should you pay it off in 30 years or 25 years, the answer is neither. It's 10 to 15 years, so you can get on with your life. 404-872-0750. I'm Elise Glink, sitting in for Clark. We'll be right back with more on News Talk WSB.
This is Clark. I'm not here today, but you're still getting money-saving info from money expert and author Elise Glink on News Talk WSB.
56 minutes past the hour. News Talk WSB. I'm Elise Glink. Thanks for joining us today on the Clark Howard Show. Our number 404-872-0750. Shirley joins us on the line from North Carolina. Hi, Shirley.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm great. What can I do for you?
Yes. Well, my spending, if I knew what I know now with age, maybe I'd have a little bit more.
Okay. Well, I can't go backwards, but I can go forwards.
That's true. You can't. What's already went under the bridge.
It is.
But what I am calling concerning is long-term care.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a good thing to do or what? My husband has just had a heart attack.
Ooh.
And he is doing good, though, and he's been healthy. He was a textbook, perfect blood work and everything, but it's something happened to the genes is what the doctors, you know, they say the genes and everything else is right. But it's made me think.
How old are you?
I'm 66.
And how old is your husband?
70.
he may or may not be able to get long-term care insurance now that he's had a heart attack. I don't know. You'll have to check it out.
As long as he doesn't have another one in the amount of months that the company I'm talking
whatever
to.
You're... Okay. So long-term care insurance, typically if you're going to buy it, sometime between your late 50s and early 60s is the best idea because it's the cheapest. It's going to get a little bit more expensive as you get older, and you have to watch out for a few things. You want to make sure that it has a COLA, cost of living adjustment. You want to understand if
you mean like inflation.
Inflation, exactly. You want to make sure that there's an inflation adjustment every year. You also want to check and see if it has any kind of home health care benefits. A lot of times long-term care insurance will give you that, but you have to make sure it's included. You have to really understand what the benefit package is, and there are elder law attorneys who can help you go through that if you don't understand it yourselves. I would shop around, and remember, if it's going to cost you like $10,000 or $20,000 a year, you're far better off paying self-insuring and putting that money aside for yourself down the line, since the average stay is only about 3 years for those who need it. 58 minutes past the hour. I'm Elise Klink. Stay tuned. We've got more of the Clark Howard Show coming up next. News Talk WSB.
Is Clark Howard on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM News Talk WSB.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Clark Howard Show. Glad to have you on board today. 404-872-0750. I'm Elise Klink, sitting in for Clark today. He'll be back tomorrow. Delighted to have you on board. My website is thinkglink.com, thinkglink.com. Sign up for the free weekly newsletter. Don't forget to stop by mymoneywatch.com blog, where we've been blogging about what you can buy for $3,000 or less. And I'm talking about a house, not a car, a house. What kind of houses and properties that can you buy for $3,000 or less, all on MoneyWatch.com. And for the home blog over at Equifax.com, the Equifax personal finance blog, yesterday I posted about that Harvard Center Joint Housing Studies report looking at the housing industry, and where we talked about this yesterday, but for those of you who are stopping by today, where the housing market is going, housing market predictions, we talked about that yesterday, up on the Equifax personal finance blog at equifax.com/blog. So we've watched at least one or two Republicans enter the presidential race. It's sort of interesting that we're a year and 3 months out from a presidential election, and you know, you would think that there would just be a flood of people running. But there's been such dreary economic news that I wonder if everybody's just kind of sitting back and waiting to see what's going to happen as we get through the summer. And this kind of dreary economic malaise, let's call it, sort of a dreary jobs report. We're looking at, you know, inflation, which is sort of holding steady. Fed thinks it's not going to be a problem. We're looking at inflation-adjusted median income for American families actually fell between 2000 and 2009. It's very, very weak. Median income is falling, you know, fell for 7 years before the recession struck, so in the early 80s. Now we've got the, you know, recession included in that. We've got jobs, of course, on the decline. And so it's kind of interesting that if we had had other economic sort of normal life, like if we'd actually had a normal economy for the last 10 or 12 years, like we did under the 80s and 90s, we would have seen at least 4 years of economic growth above 4% in each of those decades. And since the 1990s, we've had exactly 1 year of 4% growth, and that was in 2000. So we're now looking, as we go into the presidential election, of 11 years at subpar growth in this country. I wonder if we're forgetting what regular, normal, healthy growth even feels like, because we sure haven't been seeing it. So it's kind of interesting that there's this kind of malaise that's settled over. And I think it's really apparent when you look at like consumer confidence survey. So like our confidence is down. And it's not just because we all know people close to us who've been unemployed for at least a year. I think it's also because we get the sense that maybe what's going on right now is going to be with us for a number of years to come. And I think that's a very scary thought. The idea that it isn't just, you know, I don't know, 8 minutes till the next commercial break, or in this case, not just a year and a half until the stock, you know, we've had the stock market zooming, but when do our jobs come back? When does our financial life come back? When do we have to stop worrying about every single cent we spend? Well, maybe never. It's very, very interesting. So I think all of this is going to become, you know, clearly the deficit is a focus for the election, no question. But there's a bigger issue that we have in this country right now, this issue of trust. And I think there's a profound lack of trust, not just in the government and its ability to regulate and make things work for us that are too big for any one company, but also the idea that the financial institutions that basically run this country or make this country run aren't working well either. And we don't trust them because we don't trust how they've behaved and how they've treated us. So it's kind of interesting to see where we're going and how we feel about it. And certainly having so many people out of work, so many people cashing in their 401ks, worrying about what the future is going to hold is not a great way to go into a presidential election. Because I don't think that everybody feels like the other side, whatever side you're on, that the other side has it right or wrong, the other side has the right answers. I'm not sure we all feel that way. So it makes us uncomfortable, right? And the malaise sets in. So it'll be interesting to see how it all shakes out. But what I'd really like to see are jobs and a change of attitude. 404-872-0750, and I don't mean individual attitudes, I mean the country attitude. I mean all of us changing our consumer sentiment and having a reason to feel good about looking forward again. 12 minutes past the hour, 404-872-0750. Let's go back to the phones. Steve joins us on the line from Alpharetta. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Elise. Always enjoy when you fill in for Clark. Thanks for doing it.
Oh, thank you.
Well, I want to talk to you a little bit about what I've done over the last 6 months as far as spending, that type of thing. I purchased a townhome at about 40% off.
Nice.
Foreclosure, brand new. We love it. Plan on living there a very long time. 3.875 on a 15-year fixed.
Love it.
Also, purchased a new car back in 2009 in July and had a rate of about 4.875. Loved the car. Got a letter from the manufacturer. Hey, we want your trade-in, blah, blah, blah. Long story short, Elise, I drove out with a brand new car, 0% financing for 60 months.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm thinking, trying to decide to do, if I'm better off to pay that car off in 36 months. Now, again, it is 0%. And then start attacking the mortgage. Or should I pay them both out over time? Because I've got such a favorable rate on the mortgage loan and then 0% on the car.
Let me tell you something. You're paying almost, I would not prepay these debts.
Okay.
If you want to prepay the car, do the car, even though it's 0% financing, just to get rid of that other payment. But, you know, your interest rate on the loan, 3.8%, a Nobel Prize winning economist, Robert Fogel, told me last year, but if you can get 3.8%, and my 15 years right around there, he said it's like free money. If you get any number, any amount of write-off, maybe you do or you're so low you don't, it's seriously like free money. So you want to keep that in place because you want to have your cash available to make other kinds of investments.
See,
and there will be other kinds of investments to come.
Right. That was my next question. I've got about 3 months living expense stuck back. And that's what I'm wondering, should I build that up to like 6 months and then maybe start working on the car loan?
Absolutely. I'd love to see you have 6 months in cash. You know,
okay.
People like me used to say, you know, if you had 3 to 6 months, you were safe, you know,
right,
of expenses. But today, having seen what's going on and the longevity of the unemployment, not that you're going to lose your job, but I just feel more comfortable at 6 months to 8 months. So having 6 months in the bank, great. It just gives you even more options. So I would do that, and then you can start paying off all of these other, you know, loans if you want. I seriously, though, the house loan,
yes,
it's already so cheap.
Right. Now, we'll probably keep this car for 10 to 15 years, seriously.
Great.
We love the car, so, okay, that sounds like a plan. Thanks so much, Elise. I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Thanks for sharing your plan. I love it. 15 minutes past the hour, 404-872-0750. Let's continue on with our calls. Kavita joins us on the line from Los Angeles. Kavita, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I had this question for you. My family owns an apartment in New York, and my sister's kind of the landlady as such. And she's had tenants in there for the past 18 months, and there's never been a problem. And the other day, they discovered a bed bug.
Ew.
And
yuck.
Yuck, indeed. And so they had an exterminator come in today who checked the whole thing out, just found the one bed bug in a mattress, but, you know, checked the whole apartment. There was nothing else there. And so, but anyway, the tenants want to have the exterminator come back for at least two treatments, which will run about $3,000, to exterminate the entire apartment. And they basically want my sister to pay for it. So the question is, I mean, given that it's been 18 months and they're never, I mean, they're saying it could have been a plumber that came in that maybe tracked it in, or the apartment's next to the trash compactor, and could that have been the issue? So,
it's just as likely they went to the movie theater and sat back on a seat, and somebody who had the bed bug sat there, and the bed bug crawled on them, and their clothes went on it.
Right.
I mean,
exactly.
I think that you have to look and see what your lease says.
Right.
And I am not a knowledgeable expert in New York rental tenant law.
Right.
But you know, if they can make the case that there's an infestation, which one bed bug would not necessarily an infestation make, but New York has gone so bananas with bed bugs.
Right.
That I really don't know what the city will require you to do. And if they call the city on you, that is a big pain in the neck.
Right.
So you have to decide what your, first look at your lease agreement.
Okay.
And then you have to decide how much this is going to kill you.
Right.
Then you have to decide when their lease is up and if you want to lease the apartment to somebody else.
Right.
Instead of them. And you can perfectly well decline to renew the lease.
Right.
And then you can have somebody else come in.
Okay. Yeah, I think they still have 6 months left on it.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm not mistaken. But, you know, my sister just doesn't want it to become a thing where they're going back and forth with lawyers and things like that. She asked them, you know, have you traveled? Have you maybe bought? And they didn't answer the question.
Of course, because they've brought it back from wherever it is. I would say that, you know, you have to look to see what your lease says. You've already had it exterminated once. Again, I'm not a lawyer, and you probably need a New York real estate lawyer to help with this.
Okay.
But it may be fair to say, hey, we'll split the cost with you because we don't want to have a problem.
Right.
But we're not willing to pay the whole thing.
Right.
Or we'll bring them back one more time just to see if there are any other bed bugs. And if there are, then we can have a discussion about that. But, you know, split the cost with us because we didn't deliver an apartment to you with bed bugs.
Right.
And, you know, our position is you might have brought them in yourself.
Right.
So you can certainly go in that position. But, again, I'm not a lawyer, and I'm certainly not an expert in landlord-tenant law in New York City.
Right.
So I'd want you to make sure that you are on the right side of things.
I understand. Well, no, this is very helpful. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for calling the show. 18 minutes past the hour, 404-872-0750. Let's see what we can do with Jerry. Jerry, welcome to the program.
I told him all.
Jerry?
Yes.
Hi. Welcome to the Clark Howard Show. How can I help you today?
Yes, we've been having, I guess, we bought a high-end electronic device a few years back, a high-definition television.
Mm-hmm.
Back when they were first becoming on the market.
Yep.
We decided, at the convincing of the company that we purchased the television from, to also buy a warranty for a few-year warranty, specifically a 4-year warranty. Towards the end of the warranty, our television started to have problems. Basically, it started freezing.
Hmm.
First, we thought it was a cable problem because it would freeze on television programs.
Sure.
Then it started freezing in the middle of DVDs, as well as video games, because we have it hooked up to the television as well.
Got it.
So we decided to follow the warranty procedure, called the warranty of the company, which the company decided to go through a subcontractor through.
Uh-huh.
So we went through the procedure, had a technician come out, take a look at the television. They replaced motherboards on the television. It did not fix the problem. During the procedure, the warranty lapsed. But the problem was still persistent.
Well, but you filed the complaint about the problem itself, and they weren't able to fix it. It was during the warranty period. Are they now claiming that you're out of warranty?
That is one of the problems that they are claiming, yes.
Okay, you can file a class, not a class action, I'm sorry. You can file a small claims court.
Okay.
To force them to comply, but, you know, all extended warranties are pretty much a bad deal. Because typically HDTVs are pretty reliable, so you actually had a problem and you had the warranty, so I guess the general Clark Howard advice, you know, is a little bit late for you. But, you know, if you can't, you know, you can file all kinds of complaints. You can certainly file a lawsuit in small claims court to force them to replace the television or to repair it. And that's pretty much what you can do. You'll get their attention, that's for sure. You might even, I don't know if you've done this yet, but you can also try to go up to, you know, a little bit higher up. And, of course, you know, into the vice president level or senior vice president of customer experience at the company and try and get to the top person and just file your complaint there as well. But usually when I've seen this work out is when you start getting either some media involved, hello, Clark Howard, or you actually file a lawsuit, and that typically is when they start paying attention. WSB's Clark Howard is giving away thousands of dollars in free gas. It is 3:20, and Sean Wren, you have won free gas at your Kroger Fuel Center. So you have to call now to claim your prize. You have 30 minutes. Sean Wren of Alpharetta, call us now, 404-741-0750. We hope to hear from you. It is 21 minutes past the hour. I'm Elise Glink. You're listening to News Talk WSB.
This is Clark. I'm not here today, but you're still getting money-saving info from money expert and author Elise Glink on News Talk WSB.
27 minutes past the hour on the Clark Howard Show. I'm Elise Glink, 404-872-0750. Wesley joins us on the line from Canton. Hi, Wesley. Wesley?
Yes?
There you are. Welcome to the Clark Howard Show.
Hi, Elise. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
The question is this. My wife and I are about to refi and in the next month or two, and I'm trying to figure out if it makes more sense to go ahead and open up an additional line of credit vis-a-vis a credit card or just to stay put because the ding on the credit this close to possible refinance might be so dramatic.
Yeah, I wouldn't do anything like open up a new line of credit right now. The last time I opened up, I have great credit. It's over 800. And the last time I opened up a new credit card, my credit score dipped about 30 points for 2 or 3 months.
Okay.
And then came right back up. But why would you want to do that to, you know, just before you refinance your house?
Exactly. Okay.
So leave it be. Have you taken a look at your credit history, credit score?
I have not. I need to do that. We were just been pondering this for a while, and just we're about to go ahead and get the information to mortgage broker to find out some of the particulars.
Okay. Well,
and just
before you do that, I want you to go to annualcreditreport.com, pull a copy of your credit history and credit score, credit history from each of the three credit reporting bureaus. Pull your credit score from Equifax. It's about $9. Best place to do it, if you don't want to do it there, go to myfico.com, M-Y-F-I-C-O.com, and you can pull it from there as well. You want to see what's on your credit report before any lender takes a look at it, just to be sure. 28 minutes past the hour, 404-872-0750. We will be right back with more answers to your questions on the Clark Howard Show here on News Talk WSB.
Clark Howard on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM News Talk WSB.
Six minutes past the hour on the Clark Howard Show. I'm Elise Blink sitting in for Clark today. He'll be back tomorrow. So glad you could join us here at News Talk WSB. So wouldn't you like to stick it in the eye of a bank that foreclosed on your house when you actually bought it with cash? Well, that's how one family feels, and they actually kind of got the opportunity to do it. So it turns out that this couple, Warren and Maureen Nyerges, I'm going to hope that's how I pronounce their names, they bought a foreclosure with cash from Bank of America. And 4 months after they bought the house with cash, Bank of America called them and started foreclosure proceedings for not paying their mortgage, which they didn't have. So it was kind of a comedy of errors because they would get people on the phone and they'd say, you have to pay, you have to pay. And he said it just was unclear why that happened. And they couldn't get anybody to talk to them, so the house went into foreclosure. So they fought the foreclosure, and the couple went to, they said something like 20 different, 25 different law firms over 18 months trying to get somebody to take the case. Nobody would take the case. When he went to court to represent himself, he said that lawyers for the bank filed incorrect motions and were woefully unprepared. The husband is a 46-year-old retired police officer, and he said it was just absolutely insane. And they found a lawyer who would help them. They fought the foreclosure, and they won, and they proved that they owned the home outright. Now, the judge was so incensed that that the judge ordered Bank of America to pay the couple $2,500 in attorney's fees. And I asked my husband, Sam, who's an attorney, if it's normal to have attorney's fees assigned in this case, and he said absolutely not. He said the judge must have been really upset. So the judge assigns Bank of America to pay the fees, and the bank doesn't pay them. And so the couple went back to the judge and said, we want to seize their assets, because that's what you do when somebody owes you money and they're not paying you. You seize their assets. And so they went, the sheriff's deputies came up, and they had a truck, a moving truck, and they went up to the branch office in Naples with the attorney, and they basically were going to lock up the door of the bank. So the branch manager came out, was visibly shaken. I mean, they were going to take the desk and the chair that the branch manager was sitting in just to prove the point. About an hour later, the bank had written a check for $5,772, almost three times what the judge had originally charged, because you had to pay for the moving company and the sheriff's deputies. And the family's going to get the rest of their money this week. Now, Bank of America spokeswoman Jumana Bowens apologized to the family, but it turns out that the law firm that Bank of America was using was the law office of David J. Stern. And David J. Stern has gotten into a whole lot of trouble in Florida because it has been involved in over 100,000 foreclosure cases. These guys are at the center of the robo-signing nonsense that's been going on. So the law office of David J. Stern has told judges across Florida in March that they were withdrawing from all these cases. And the Florida Attorney General's Economic Crimes Division is investigating three law firms, including Stern's, over the fraud allegations, fraud legal documents, gouging homeowners with inflated fees, steering business to companies they owned, and filing foreclosures without proving the bank actually had a legal interest in the loans, or, in this case, had a loan at all on the property. So Stern's employees are being accused of churning out bogus mortgage assignments, faked signatures, falsified notarizations, and foreclosing on people without verifying their identities, the amounts they owed, or owned their own loans. Plus, that means they're also signing affidavits. They're signing legal documents attesting that they have done all this work, and they haven't. The Attorney General in Florida is also looking at whether David J. Stern Legal Company paid kickbacks to the big banks to get this business. Now, it's not the first time that Bank of America has foreclosed on a bunch of homeowners who didn't actually have any money that they owed to them. It's happened before. All of the big banks have had these kinds of problems. And it's just really endemic of what's been going on with the mortgage industry and the housing crisis. It's just sort of one thing after another. But these guys got out, they got paid from Bank of America, and they're on their happy way living in their happy foreclosure house. And I can only hope that the same is true for everybody else. 41 minutes past the hour on the Clark Howard Show, 404-872-0750. Let's go back to the phones. John joins us on the line. Hi, John. Welcome to the program.
Well, hi, Elise, and thank you for taking my call. It's a pleasure to speak to you.
Nice to have you on the show today. What's on your mind?
Well, I've got a kind of a unique question involving a 401k. I have just recently rolled over my 401k from a former employer to my current employer, And my wife was injured in a unique accident back in January, out of state, and lost her job because she was unable to work. So we're in a situation where we have
pending. Is she okay?
I'm sorry.
Is she okay?
Yeah. She's gotten better. She actually a waiter dropped a plate on her head from a second story balcony in New Orleans.
Oh my goodness, that is an unusual accident.
Yeah, and you know, knocked her out cold, and I mean,
wow.
She had some dizziness and blurriness of the vision for quite a while, but she is getting better. Thank you for asking. But anyhow, until she gets herself back into the workforce, I mean, she lost about a $40,000 a year job, and as we all know, jobs aren't the easiest thing to come by right now. You know, we're in a position where a lawsuit is pending. We're going to need anywhere from $5,000 to $10,000 to get through until this lawsuit is settled. I've talked to my investment firm, and I have access to up to $40,000 for up to 5 years at a guaranteed rate of 5.25%, which I'm a little happier about because I found out I'm actually paying myself the 5.25% and not somebody else to use my own money. But my question is, you know, what kind of gotchas or watch outs do I need to be looking for here if I do take, and I'm leaning on getting that full $40,000 and paying off some of the higher interest credit cards and stuff that I've got through like home improvement companies and things like that are, you know, 25-26%.
Okay, let me jump in and say, so it sounds like you're borrowing from your 401k until this lawsuit is settled. You only need $5,000 to $10,000, but you're talking about taking out $40,000.
Correct.
What's the, you know, how much money do you think you're going to settle for with this case? Because I'd really like to see you at the end of the lawsuit be back to even and your wife out looking for another job. I mean, do you feel like you're going to get $100,000 out of this or just $10,000?
We don't know. I mean, you know, we've got over $30,000 of medical bills that, you know, are, you know, most have been paid for by our insurance company, but obviously they're going to probably want their money back. You know, it could be $100,000, it could be $50,000, it could be, you know, $250,000. We really don't know. And of course, our attorney firm isn't willing to even come up with a possible number.
Okay. Well, they're going to take a big chunk, probably 30 or 40% anyway.
Correct.
So whatever it is you get, you have to factor that in. I think if you want to take the $40,000 and you're going to use it to pay off 25% credit card bills, that's fine. But I really want you to have a plan, because if something happens and you have to leave this company, you're going to have to pay all that money back sort of instantly within 60 days. So I really want to make sure that whatever it is you choose to do, that you figure out how you're going to get that money paid off, preferably in a couple of years. Now, it sounds like if the lawsuit settles, you could get money right away and pay that back, because it sounds like you're going to spend $10,000 just on your regular bills, and then you'll have a little extra cash floating around. But just in case it doesn't go in your direction, you're never really sure that it's going to go in your direction, you really want to make sure you have a plan for getting that money paid off. And that would be my big gotcha. That's my only concern, because I just wouldn't want you in a situation where you have to leave your job, but you can't because you owe this money. 404-872-0750. Let's continue on. Eric joins us on the line from Gwinnett County. Hi, Eric.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks so much for having me on.
We're doing great. What's going on with you?
Well, I was kind of wondering, you know, what the deal is with the economy. I mean, to me, you know, I really enjoy the work you and Clark and Dave do and continue to try and educate myself with my finances. And I'm wondering, you know, if that's not just a huge part of the pickle that the American economy is in right now.
That you guys were telling you not to spend money?
No. I really like the advice you guys are giving. I'm just wondering if that's not a widespread enough word, and that's, you know, part of the huge problem we're having.
Well, I think that, you know, Clark has been on the air, I don't know, 17, 18 years, and I've been filling in for him since, I want to say, like 1997 or 98, so about 14 of those years. And Dave is new to the station, but he's been around for a while, Dave Ramsey. And I think that all of us feel very strongly that, that one of the big problems out there right now is that people just simply don't have enough jobs. There are a whole lot of people who have who lost their jobs in this recession. They haven't gotten them back. We've had sort of median income falling on an inflation-adjusted basis over the last 10 years, so family income is going down. Expenses are going up. They can say all day long that there is no inflation, but honestly, when I'm spending $80 to fill up my tank, I feel like that's pretty expensive. So I think that that's what's going on right now. People are just, not enough people are employed. A fifth of all men in this country who are of working age are not employed right now. One-fifth, 20%. It's way too many.
Yeah, it's been real tough out there. There's no doubt about that. I've been fighting the fight myself.
Well, then you know.
So do you think with the bubble that they say burst, I mean, is that because, you know, people weren't financially responsible as they should have been? I mean, because money is power.
I would jump in and just say that I think that people, if they get a sense there's free or easy money, will take the money and then think about what they're doing later. I think
right.
It was real easy to tap into home equity. Everybody told you this was like a piggy bank. Use your house as, well, not me, Clark and Dave, but everybody else said tap into your house, use it to fix it up, use it to buy a car, go on a vacation. There were lots of messages out there for people, and I think that some people lost their way. They got simply sidetracked from what their right financial path was, and then they lost their job, and the bottom fell out of their financial life, and they found themselves in a very tough situation. So I kind of think when the bubble burst, that's what happened. People started losing their jobs. These home, you know, they got suckered into loans that they didn't understand. They didn't take the time to find out about. Some of those loans were bad. Now people are going into foreclosure simply because they don't have jobs that pay anything. So
right.
I think we have to really fix the problem here, what we really need to do is we have to figure out how to get people employed. And as I've often said, you know, if you take $1 trillion, which I know is a lot of money, and it adds to the deficit at the moment, but if you actually just did a roads, bridges, and schools plan, and you rebuilt the crumbling highway and crumbling infrastructure, there are jobs that you can't outsource. People pay taxes on that money, so a bunch of it comes back to Treasury, and the rest gets spent out in the economy. Not a bad way to go. It's just not a bad way to go. And it really, if we don't start rebuilding some of our crumbling infrastructure in this country, we're going to be in big trouble. Eric, thanks so much for your call and your comment. It's 49 minutes past the hour on the Clark Howard Show, 404-872-0750. We're going to have show notes up at thinklink.com, at the blog. Check it out after the show, and I'll try to get up that credit freeze information for you.
This is Clark. I'm not here today, but you're still getting money-saving info from money expert and author Elise Glink on News Talk WSB.
Five minutes past the hour on the Clark Howard Show. I'm Elise Glink, sitting in today. It's been a lot of fun. Glad you've been able to join us. We are at 404-872-0750 and online all the time. Thinkglink.com, thinkglink.com. Visit my website, sign up for the free weekly newsletter, learn all kinds of great tips that are going to make you smarter with your own money. All right, let's see if we can take another call or two. Dan joins us on the line. Hi, Dan. Welcome to the Clark Howard Show.
How are you this afternoon?
You know, it's a great afternoon always to sit on the air with you guys. What's going on?
Well, I need your advice. My wife and I have worked hard to save our money over the years, and we have a sizable rainy day fund.
Mm-hmm.
It's about $100,000 in cash sitting in the bank. Our only debt is our mortgage, which is a 15-year, just over 4%.
Okay.
And I've thought about taking about half the cash and trying to do something with it to earn more than what a money market would pay, something that's semi-liquid. And I wanted to get your thoughts on that. I've looked at CDs, maybe a dividend-paying stock or a bond. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Sure. Anything you do is going to have a little bit of risk or maybe a lot in risk. So earlier on the show, I recommended that you think about maybe taking half of the money, or in this case, half of the half, and you can put it into a 6-month or a 1-year CD. and you can put the rest into, say, an 18-month or a 2-year CD. In your case, you have a lot of cash on hand, plenty for your emergency fund.
Yes.
I mean, you could even do 6 months in a year and then just keep rolling it over. It's not worth it right now to put lock up something for 4 or 5 years. Just not going to be worth it. You're not going to get the return on investment for that kind of risk. Because in 4 or 5 years, interest rates could be significantly higher than they are now, and you won't want to have your money locked up. So that would be...
You'd ladder some short-term CDs over the next year or two.
You betcha. You betcha. And if you wanted to take a little bit more risk, you could try a short-term bond fund.
Mm-hmm.
And you might get a little bit more than that. You could buy some dividend-paying stocks, but the concern is that you could lose money very quickly. So I am not such a huge fan of that. But you could take, say, $20,000, and you could put it in an S&P, you know, or a total stock market fund, and you can just take a little bit of risk with a fifth of it, and everything else just stays in the CD. So there are ways to kind of split it up and take a little bit of risk without taking a whole lot of risk. And maybe that's just what you want to do right now. And congratulations on having that much in cash. It definitely gives you options. 58 minutes past the hour. Sean Hannity comes in next. We've had a little Adele this hour. Hope you've enjoyed it. Stop by Sundays at 11 to 1 on News Talk WSB. Join us for the Sunday Live Elise Klink Show. We're always looking ahead to what you can expect to see in the week and always surprised by the week we've left behind these days. All right, I'm going to go head out and enjoy what's left of this beautiful, hot, sunny afternoon. I hope you go and do the same. In the meantime, Sean is next. Stay tuned to News Talk WSB.